Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Journal Republican, reading stories dated July 30th through August 5th, 2020. We'll start with the article headlined Second Candidate on Ballot for Judge by Steve Hoffman, August 5th. It is officially a two-way race on the November ballot for the upcoming 6th Judicial Court judge opening in Piatt County. Piatt County Attorney Suzanne Jennings Wells filed her nominating petitions to run under the party she formed, the Lincoln Heritage Party. The required number of petitions were filed with the Illinois State Board of Elections by the July 20th deadline. She faces Republican candidate Dana Rhodes in the general election on November 3rd. The winner will be sworn in as the replacement for retiring Judge Hugh Finson. Wells has been a licensed attorney for more than 30 years and owns the law offices of Suzanne Wells in Monticello. She's the current president of the Piatt County Bar Association. More information on her campaign is available on her Facebook site, Suzanne Jennings Wells for Piatt County Circuit Judge 2020. Rhodes has been elected to the post of Piatt County State's Attorney three times, holding that office since December of 2008. She was the only candidate to run in the spring primary, securing the Republican nomination. More information on her campaign is available on the Facebook site Dana Rhodes for Piatt County Circuit Judge 2020. Steve Thomas, another Monticello attorney, had also announced he would run under a party he would form, but was not listed as being on the ballot on the Illinois State Board of Elections website. Gabby's Law Could Go National by Steve Hoffman, August 5th. Sepsis claims about 300,000 lives and costs about $41.5 billion to fight in the United States. One of those lives lost was Monticello 5-year-old Gabriel Gabby Galbo, who died in 2012 after an undetected tick bite developed into the extreme infection of sepsis. Her father, Tony Galbo, made a promise on that day to help make sure others would not feel the pain his family felt. On May 11th, 2012, when my 5-year-old daughter Gabby died, I held her body in my arms and made a promise to her that I would get Gabby's law so that no other parents would have to walk in our shoes, Galbo said. That led to the passage of Gabby's Law in 2016, which requires hospitals in Illinois to implement evidence-based processes for quickly recognizing and treating sepsis. Now, Congressman Rodney Davis, Republican from Taylorville, wants to make it a federal law. Appearing with the Galbo family at Gabby's gazebo in Monticello on Tuesday, the U.S. representative promoted House Resolution 7514, which, if enacted, would require all hospitals to adopt, implement, and periodically update using the best evidence-based sepsis protocols. Davis thanked Illinois Senator Chapin Rose and former Representative Bill Mitchell for getting the law passed in Illinois, but added, "We've got to do more. We've got to make sure that we have a national approach to helping put better protocols in our hospitals to ensure that sepsis is not missed like it was in Gabby's case." Noting the high death count of sepsis, a body's extreme response to an infection, Davis pointed out it is preventable. Many of those sepsis victims could have been cured as long as it was diagnosed initially, he said. The federal law mirrors the Illinois one, with one enforcement stick that Davis feels will make it even more effective: the withholding of Medicaid reimbursements for hospitals that do not comply. That's a big stick, but it's important, said the congressman. Galbo pointed out that sepsis is the leading cause of deaths in hospitals nationwide, yet only 4 states mandate protocols. "We must do better. We have to do better," said Galbo, who was on hand with his wife, Liz, and children Filippo and Giada. "Patients presenting with signs and symptoms must be screened for sepsis with the same urgency as heart attack or stroke patients." Davis said he's waiting to get a hearing in the House, the next step towards possible passage. Landon Stenger, the chief of staff for Senator Rose, noted it is an easy cause for all parties to get behind. "This is not a partisan issue. It passed in Illinois on a bipartisan basis. And it's not a Democrat or Republican issue. It's just good policy. We obviously support this wholeheartedly," he said. Galbo thanked Congressman Davis for helping him keep his vow to his daughter. A big thank you to Congressman Rodney Davis for getting Gabby's law federally introduced and continuing my promise nationwide. Coaches react to IHSA sports season changes by Jason Brown. August 5th. Since the Illinois High School Association, IHSA, Board of Directors announced on July 29th its intended plans for the 2020-21 school year, athletic directors and coaches from all over Illinois have been scrambling to implement new guidelines. Monticello Activities Director Daniel Sheehan has been working nearly nonstop to adjust to IHSA's unprecedented scheduling changes for the 2020-21 school year. The scheduling changes include playing all sports over the course of truncated fall, winter, spring, and summer seasons. The plan has been sent to the Illinois Department of Health, IDPH, for final approval. Football, boys soccer, and girls volleyball are scheduled to shift from fall to the spring schedules. To learn as much as possible about the new guidelines, Sheehan participated in a webinar with the IHSA Monday of last week to get a better understanding of the season expectations that have been placed under these circumstances and to get a better understanding of what's determined as region. Tuesday, Sheehan joined an Illini Prairie Conference webinar to discuss several scheduling and guideline matters. Wednesday, Sheehan was part of an IESA webinar because a week after announcing the cancellation of multiple junior high fall sports on July 31st, IESA Executive Director Steve Ensley informed member schools of a reversal and provided a plan for the entire 2020-21 athletic calendar. "This will have to look different," Sheehan said. "Some of the expectations for cross-country were that there could be a three-team maximum and no invites. So we're going to have to be creative to how we do things, on how we set up events and tournaments and golf outings and cross-country invites and wrestling tournaments." Sheehan is digesting all the various information and taking it one step at a time to figure out what's going to be allowed and what is not. "The challenge is when we're trying to do what's best for our kids, trying to make things work," Sheehan said. "We also have to take into account our conference schools. What is okay here may look different in Chillicothe. We're trying to make sure that their kids are safe and our kids are safe and that we're all on the same page, really working together to find our kids." The tentative dates for fall sports are August 10th to October 24th, which schedules for girls and boys golf, cross-country, and girls swimming and diving. Winter sports from November 16th to February 13th are scheduled to include boys and girls basketball, boys swimming and diving, cheerleading, dance, bowling, and gymnastics. Spring sports from February 15th to May 1st are scheduled to include football, boys soccer, volleyball, badminton, boys gymnastics, and water polo. The summer sports from May 3rd to June 26th are scheduled to include baseball, softball, boys and girls track and field, girls soccer, boys volleyball, lacrosse, and boys tennis. Sheehan is checking to see if there is a potential scheduling with coaches who are coaching more than one team. Kim Allison is the varsity volleyball coach and the seventh grade coach, and though Sheehan does not think the seasons will overlap, it will be close. "We don't have specific dates of when tournaments are going to be held, if they are held, so there's still a lot of information we haven't been given about potential regional play or postseason play," Sheehan said. Coach Cully Welter may have to go from football straight into track. "We're going to have to look at a little bit of everything and all the overlaps," Sheehan said. "The only thing that comes into play is all the gym space and availabilities to make sure we can have the opportunity for kids to get practicing and follow the guidelines that have been put forth in front of us." Sheehan hopes students, parents, and coaches can be patient during the process, and Sheehan receives and shares information. "As of right now, no schedule is guaranteed," Sheehan said. "We're reworking those, and we'll get them shared as soon as we can. We're going to do our best to try to have opportunities for our kids to have an opportunity to compete." This plan, like nearly every aspect of our current lives remains fluid, said IHSA Executive Director Craig Anderson. Changes may come, and if they do, we will be agile while putting safety and students first. It was important that we provide a framework today for our student athletes, coaches, administrators, and officials to begin preparing for the 2020-21 school year. School Project on Time and Budget by Steve Hoffman, August 4th. As of the end of July, Monticello School construction is on time and under budget. But the COVID-19 crisis means the district will not be able to show off the completed new spaces as planned this fall. That includes a two-floor high school science wing addition, a classroom wing addition at Washington Elementary, and the Arthur Buzz Severs Center Gymnasium. The ultimate plan, if not for COVID, was to have a community open house at the start of school, said School Superintendent Vic Zimmerman. We're not going to be able to do that now because of COVID. We may do a video. The superintendent can't wait to show it off. Our community is going to be unbelievably proud of the product that they voted yes for, he said. We made great efforts to combine the existing 1921 building, the high school, with the existing facility. One of those efforts people will eventually see is the original north wall of the high school, which is still visible inside an internal hallway. Construction manager Mark Kaufman told the school board July 29th that things are tracking very well on the construction project. He noted the school building shutdowns in March enabled contractors to get early starts on remodeling work at the high school, but then having full complements of construction crews had been a challenge during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm very pleased with the men and women that we've had to work through this. I couldn't be more pleased with the subs, contractors, we've got. As of right now, the project is tracking very, very well, right on target, he added. Among projects that are complete or should be complete by the start of school September 2nd, the Arthur Buzz Severs Center, which is down to bleacher installation, a dedication that had been scheduled for the first volleyball game August 25th, will now have to wait until basketball season, since volleyball has been moved to the spring this year. New classrooms at Washington Elementary. High school administrative area remodel. 1966 high school math rooms. New high school science classroom and labs addition. Mechanical room addition. Renovation work on Washington Elementary administrative areas are going well as rehab work in the existing high school and Washington campus. The project is set for completion by the start of the 2021-22 school year. Zimmerman also said the effort may beat its $35.2 million budget by as much as $1 million. At this point, it appears that we should come in under budget, said Zimmerman, who qualified that statement. Like, Mark is hesitant to hear me say that we're ahead of schedule, and he will never say that. I'm hesitant to say we will come in under budget. But I'm confident we will not be over budget at this point. Right now, based on the numbers that I'm looking at, and a budget of $35.2 million, I'm expecting us to come in about $34.2 million. Voters approved a referendum in November of 2017 to provide funding for the construction project. In other action at the July 29th board session, work continues on the formation of an equity and diversity work group. Zimmerman said it will likely have two facilitators, up to two school board members, 10 school staff members, 10 parents, and 5 students. The group will meet about 6 times and issue a non-binding report to the school board in December. A tentative budget approved for 2020-21 shows an overall budget deficit of $1.4 million in the district's 4 main operating funds. Zimmerman said it's due to an anticipated 25% drop in corporate personal property replacement tax, which is based on corporate profits. The district received about $7.1 million in CPPRT dollars during 2019-20, but only has $5.5 million plugged into the tentative budget for 2020-21. The district has plenty of fund reserves to get through, including $4.7 million in its education fund, $1.5 million in operations and maintenance, and $3 million in its working cash account. A change order 12, was approved for the construction project. Encompassing several small changes, it saves about $1,700. Overall, change orders have benefited the project's bottom line by about $19,000 at this point. Board members voted to keep closed minutes from January to June of 2020 closed. Zimmerman said the 2019-20 year was a solid one financially for the district. The Education and Operation and Maintenance Funds both ended the year $400,000 better than the budget estimated. And a first reading of board policy updates was reviewed. It includes allowing remote meetings during the COVID-19 pandemic, along with amendments to the pandemic preparedness policy. Formal approval is expected at the August 19th meeting. Obituaries. Loretta Lorraine Brown, age 100, passed away on Sunday, August 2nd, at Piatt County Nursing Home in Monticello. As per her wishes, Lorraine will be cremated. There will be no services held at this time. Robert E. Bob Tompkins, 52, of Mahomet, passed away August 1st at Carl Hospital, Urbana. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, August 6th, at the Mackey Wright Funeral Home, Monticello. Graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, August 7th, at the Monticello Township Cemetery. There will be a celebration of life held at the Community Evangelical Free Church of Mahomet at 6 p.m. Friday, August 7th. We encourage anyone that knew and loved Bob to attend any of these that you wish. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Concussion Legacy Foundation. https://concussionfoundation.org. Florence Lillian Kingsborough, 96, of Farmer City, passed away August 2nd at the Piatt County Nursing Home, Monticello. Graveside services will be at 2 p.m. Thursday, August 6th, at DeLand Cemetery, DeLand. There will be no visitation. Memorials may be directed to the Piatt County Nursing Home. Terry Lee Lawson, 65, of Bement, passed away on Wednesday, July 29th, at the Kirby Medical Center, Monticello. Private funeral services were held on Monday, August 3rd, at the Hines Funeral Home in Bement. Memorial contributions can be made to the Harbor Light Hospice Program, 332 West Marion Street, Suite N1, Forsyth, 62535. Holly set for grand opening August 7th through 8th. August 4th. Holly's Country Canning and Craft Kitchen will have its grand opening on Friday and Saturday, August 7th through 8th, at the restaurant's location at 1204 Bear Lane in Monticello. Owner Holly Miller had planned to celebrate earlier, but it was pushed back due to COVID-19 concerns and subsequent business shutdowns. The grand opening will include a ribbon cutting Friday, along with giveaways. Miller said she would also reveal her regular menu. We've had the opportunity to find out what meals are everyone's favorites while offering takeout throughout the past several months, so we think everyone will be happy, she said. Besides being a dine-in restaurant, Holly's carries fresh fruit jams and jellies, homemade desserts, and freezer prep and take-and-bake meals. For more information, call Holly's Country Canning and Craft Kitchen at 217-762-3663. COVID-19 update. Three in same household in Mansfield test positive. By Steve Hoffman, August 4th. The DeWitt Piatt Bi-County Health Department is reporting four new cases of COVID-19 in Piatt County on August 2nd through 3rd and one additional one in DeWitt. Three of the four cases in Piatt County were from the same household in Mansfield. Everyone should be monitoring for signs and symptoms daily. If you are sick, stay home and contact your doctor or call the COVID-19 hotline to see if and when you should receive testing, said Health Department Administrator David Remmert. He also noted that close contact is defined as closer than 6 feet for more than 15 minutes. Remmert added, the infection period is 48 hours prior to the onset of signs and symptoms, and that the CDC has not recommended monitoring contacts of contacts. New cases reported on August 2nd and 3rd in Piatt County. A 20-year-old male in White Heath was reported on August 2nd. A 75-year-old male, 71-year-old female, and 51-year-old female in the same household in Mansfield were reported on August 3rd. A new case was reported on August 2nd in DeWitt County, a 71-year-old male in Farmer City. Piatt County has now recorded 44 cases of COVID-19 since early April, with no hospitalizations or deaths reported. DeWitt County has recorded 29 cases in that same period, with one hospitalization and no deaths. Monticello Board endorses return to school plan by Steve Hoffman, August 4th. Monticello's school board on July 29th approved a resolution in support of the district's return to school plan, which gives parents the option of sending students to school for in-person instruction or choose online instruction instead. Those opting for the online option will need to do so for an entire semester and must let the district know that is their preference by 12 noon Monday, August 10th. While supportive overall, input submitted to the board revolved around questions parents still have, such as a desire for more detail on both in-person protocols and online learning, how safety protocols will be followed in classrooms, and how contact tracing works if there's a positive COVID test in a student or staff member. Superintendent Vic Zimmerman said more detail will be provided in further communications with parents, but added that there's one component to the plan that everything else relies on. The key to our plan is masking, he said, noting that students will be required to wear masks while inside school buildings. If everybody masks in school 100% of the time they're supposed to, we should be in as good a shape as we can possibly be. He noted that breaks will be provided every 2 hours for students to go outside and get a break from wearing masks, and that the early dismissal, 1 to 1:15 p.m., depending on the school, is also an effort to limit the amount of time students need to be masked. Cassie McConkie spoke to the board about the plan during public comment, starting with a thank you to the team that no doubt spent many hours developing this reopening plan. She also posed questions and concerns, including contact tracing. There should be a more detailed plan for contact tracing with an accurate definition of close contact, as health departments will require this when supporting the schools during contact tracing, she said. She also thought the call for a self-quarantine should take place if someone was within 6 feet of a person who tested positive for COVID-19, whether the two parties were masked or not. The current plan calls for self-quarantine only if one was without a mask for more than 15 minutes. McConkie also asked if there would be assigned seats in classrooms to help with possible contact tracing. Zimmerman said later that there will be assigned seats for that very purpose. She urged more frequent classroom disinfecting than outlined in the plan once a week, and to clarify what constitutes an outbreak. DeWitt Piatt Bi-County Health Department Administrator Dave Remmert said his agency will be in charge of contact tracing. He noted that while our community is doing very, very well, with no deaths or hospitalizations during the COVID-19 outbreak, that you can't eliminate all the risk. As of the night of the meeting, Piatt County had registered 36 positive tests for COVID-19, 6 of whom were active cases. He also said he believes children need to be in school. All the experts that are out there, whether it's the American Academy of Pediatrics or the CDC, they all say kids need to be in school, and I firmly believe that, said Remmert. He added that student-aged children do not generally exhibit severe symptoms of COVID-19, and that research says the less the symptoms are, the less likely the virus can be transmitted. To prove his point that COVID-19 is less deadly for children, he said the CDC has reported 64 pediatric deaths nationwide from the current strain, compared to 358 during the H1N1 pandemic of 2009 and 10. He also cited CDC figures of flu season deaths that range from 27 to 187 annually from 2004-05 through 2018-19. Zimmerman added that while social distancing at least 6 feet is preferable, State back-to-school guidance recommends distancing 6 feet or to the greatest extent possible. "We're going to social distance to the greatest extent possible," he told the school board. McConkie, a teacher in another school district, was concerned for the pressure it will be to teach in person, online, and stay on top of safety protocols. "Are we asking too much of our teachers?" she said. Zimmerman noted that the most important part of the plan is where it says plan subject to change, and he feels that tweaks will be made between now and the start of school. Monticello has more time than most districts, since their start of school was already set to be later than usual to accommodate summer construction work. "We don't start in person for 5 weeks," noted Zimmerman of the September 2nd start for students. Several letters submitted by email were also read at the meeting. Many asked for more details regarding online learning. "We do need to add more detail to the online learning plan," said the superintendent, noting those details will be emailed out to parents. Area representative calls for speaker to resign. August 1st. State Representative Dan Calkins, Republican of Decatur, joined his House colleagues in calling for a vote to remove Mike Madigan as Speaker of the Illinois House of Representatives. 2 weeks ago, ComEd agreed to pay a $200 million fine for a pay-to-play scheme that allegedly involves Speaker of the House Mike Madigan, and dozens of lawmakers are calling for the Speaker's resignation. After consulting with criminal defense attorneys and carefully reviewing the court filing by the U.S. attorney, it is very clear that the government has a firm grasp of the depth and breadth of the corruption that has gripped Springfield for decades, said Calkins. "With this knowledge, I joined my fellow Republican House members and 7 Democratic members of the General Assembly calling for Speaker Madigan to step down from his leadership position." State Representative Dan Calkins recently co-sponsored H.R. 855 to remove Mike Madigan as Speaker of the House. Calkins is also urging Governor Pritzker to call a special session of the General Assembly to address Illinois' ongoing ethics crisis, and to immediately consider legislation he is sponsoring to remove Madigan from his role as House Speaker. As of July 30th, Madigan has said he will not step down as Speaker of the House. Representative Calkins added, "I hold the belief that anyone in a position of trust must be held to a higher standard of conduct. We've long suspected he was abusing his position, but this court case has legally defined his actions for all to see. It's time for Speaker Madigan to go." Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. This has been Paula Kaufman with the Herald and with the Journal Republican, reading stories from July 30th through August 5th, 2020. Please stay well. I look forward to reading with you again soon.